Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. When I think about the word judge, my mind drifts to the performative versions. Gavels, robes, closing arguments that land like thunder, objections. But the judges who actually run Fresno County courtrooms spend their days in a much quieter register. They're weighing whether a person in front of them understands the proceedings. They're waiting on a Romanian interpreter to come through Zoom. They're reading a probation report because, as I learned this week, judges don't actually get the police report. They're working off someone else's summary, someone else's framing, and trying to find the truth inside of that. There are currently 7 open seats on Fresno County Superior Court bench this June. 7. That's an extraordinary amount of change heading toward a system most of us only brush up against on our worst days. A traffic stop, an eviction, a custody fight, and yet the ballot puts these races at the very bottom, almost as an afterthought. My guests today are 2 of the candidates for these positions. Rosalina Nunez, a family and civil attorney who found her calling in second grade sitting in an immigration courtroom the day her parents' status was made legal under the Reagan-era amnesty law. And Deidre Adams, a major crimes deputy public defender whose path started at 9 years old, reading the police report from her father's death and taking notes on a Mickey Mouse pad. 2 very different doors into the same hallway. We talk about what a trial judge actually does versus what we see on TV. We talk about empathy as a working tool, not a slogan. We get into Prop 36, care courts, interpreter shortages, the new e-court rollout, AI and legal filings, juvenile sentencing, pretrial detention, and why it depends is sometimes the most honest answer a lawyer will give you. We also talk about Fresno, what it looks like from the defense table, what it looks like from the family mediation room, and what it looks like through the windshield on the way home past the tents along the road. Let's go meet Deidre Adams and Rosalina Nunez.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
Rosalina and Deidre, where do you guys like to eat in Fresno? Maybe let's start with Rosalina. Where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Oh my goodness, I am all over the place. But when I'm downtown, I love Libalula. It's over by Crest Theater. They're actually having some issues right now with the street being closed down. And so the parking is terrible right now. So you got to really want to go eat there. But it is so worth it. I love Libalula. I have lunch there with my best friend. She's also an attorney. And it's a perfect spot for us to meet at least twice a week.
Are you more of a Libalula breakfast person or a lunch person? Because those are kind of, I know they intersect. They do both really well. But where do you tend to line up?
Definitely lunch. They give you that heap of tater tots and I can't resist. Every time I go in there, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to do tater tots today. And then I just can't help myself.
Yeah, I get it too. Deidre, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
So it's a variety of places as well. And it also depends on my mood. I'll start with, I am big on comfort food. So fried fish, I love fried shrimp, I love mac and cheese and so forth. So when I'm downtown, my office is based downtown, I love Chicken King. Unfortunately, Chicken King closed down this year. It's a smaller business. But I also love Rhapsody. Rhapsody is off of Shaw. Rhapsody also has good comfort food. I love shrimp and grits. They have it once a week, typically, and fried fish and so forth. Now, if I'm in a breakfast mood, which normally I am, I love Mimi's over in River Park. That's my favorite like breakfast spot to go to. Best bakery, good muffins, and so forth. Now, if my dinner is on my mood, then I like Crack Pepper Bistro. I love that place. They have the best bread pudding and scallops. I love seafood.
Wow, you just systematically went through each meal. That was incredible. I just had them all ready to roll. That's amazing.
hungry.
Yeah, and I'm hungry too. But before we can eat lunch, we got to talk about the law here. So I'm going to start with you, Deidre, and then we'll work our way back. Can you just, in broad strokes, give us your story of your journey into working in law?
Absolutely. So first things first, my name is Deidre Adams, and I'm running for a judge of the Fresno County Superior Court. The seat is seat six. I'm currently an attorney with the Fresno County Public Defender's Office. I've been an attorney for almost 12 years. I currently am on the major crimes team, so I handle serious felony matters, murders, attempted murders, and crimes of that nature. I always tell people I didn't choose this profession. The profession chose me. So my journey essentially began when I was 9 years old. I read my first police report. It dealt with the untimely and sudden death of my father, who was in a military station in Florida, and I was in San Diego at the time, and we received a police report. Essentially, I took my Mickey Mouse pad, I wrote down my own notes, what the witnesses stated happened, manner of death, cause of death, and so forth. And I told myself then at 9 years old that I was going to be a lawyer. Now, don't ask me what my understanding of what a lawyer was at the time, but that's what I told myself at nine, and I never wavered. So throughout my high school career, I won't say career, but throughout high school, I took some courses in law that was offered in my senior year, still enjoyed it, went to undergrad, went to law school, and after that, I worked for the public defender's office, and I stand beside people at their most vulnerable moments, making sure the Constitution is upheld, making sure each case is treated with fairness, integrity, and accountability. And I think those same values should be applied as from a judge perspective on the bench.
Okay. Rosalina, how about you? Can you describe your journey into law?
Yeah, very at a very young age, I was well aware of my parents' immigrant status. It was something that was discussed at the dinner table when my uncles and aunts would cousins would come and visit. We all talked about migra, which is immigration, ICE, basically is what it's called now. But we talked about it, and it was something that was discussed at the dinner table. I was well aware that something was not okay, that we were in danger. My family was in danger of perhaps being separated, or just at my young age, I didn't know exactly what was wrong or what wasn't right, but I knew that something was up. And my parents always told me, don't tell anybody at school that we're undocumented, don't talk about it. I was born in Dos Palos here in the Central Valley. But the first half of my siblings were born in Mexico, and my parents were born in Mexico. And in second grade, Ronald Reagan was the president at the time, and he passed a law called the Amnesty Law. And it basically provided like a forgiveness to all people that had come in undocumented and allowed my parents to present themselves in court, in immigration court, and prove that they were good people, that they weren't out committing crimes, they were working hard, filing taxes, paying taxes, and basically contributing to society. And I was really excited about going to court. I got to talk to my parents' attorney. He knelt down and asked me, "What is your name?" And it was the first time that I spoke my real government name. I said, "Rosalina Nunez." And that was the first time I had said that name because my oldest brother, who's about 10 years older than I am, in trying to assimilate me, changed my name to Rosie. And so all through elementary and junior high and high school, my teachers' friends called me Rosie. But it was never a name that I felt super comfortable with because nobody at home called me that. My cousins didn't call me that. My parents certainly didn't call me Rosie. And anyway, that was a pivotal moment for me meeting that attorney and him look, he knelt down, looked me in the eye, and asked me what my name was. And then that day, he changed my parents' lives. He changed my family's lives. And we were safe. All of a sudden, we were okay to be here and we were safe and we no longer had to fear this La Migra. And so that definitely left a huge impression on who I am. And definitely, I think that was when, okay, I'm going to be a lawyer. And like Deidre, again, I wasn't absolutely sure what a lawyer did, but I knew that they did things to help families. And so that's what I wanted to do.
Wonderful. I'm going to pitch it back to Deidre now and ask a basic question, but an important one. Most people's contact with the justice system is through things like traffic tickets, maybe an eviction, a divorce, unfortunately, and possibly a DUI, which all direct towards Fresno County courts. When you're trying to explain, Deidre, what court is, I'm sure people's perception is like TV and maybe movies that they've seen, but if you were to describe
Right.
for all of us, like what does a Superior Court judge actually do versus what they see on TV? What would you say?
So a superior court judge presides over cases, and it could be a wide variety of cases, as you just mentioned. I particularly focus on criminal law. However, there's a wide variety of other areas of law, right? You've got probate issues. So you've got divorce court, as you just stated. You've got child custody dispute issues, small claims court. There are so many different areas of court and facets of the law. So a judge does preside over matters, and usually there's two different sides to a case, typically speaking, right? You've got either the plaintiff, if it's a civil case, and the defendant, or you've got the people, if it's a criminal court, representing the district attorney's office or in the defense attorney, essentially. So a judge will preside over the matters and hear the issue at hand and make a decision or ruling on the facets of the case. If it's a criminal case, it depends on what proceeding the court case is in. If it's an arraignment, then the judge makes sure that the person is arraigned fairly and accurately and so forth. And if it's down to sentencing, the judge makes sure that the time is adequate according to what the person allegedly committed the crime of. So it just depends. But there's a wide variety of issues that judges do rule over, preside over, evidentiary issues. There are different, so many different hearings. So that's a very complicated question in a sense where it depends on what stage the case is in, it depends on the type of case it is, and so forth. But the judge is the body that determines fairness, right? They bring fairness to the bench, integrity, and accountability as well.
Yeah, and Rosalina, there's an administrative role to this position as a county judge. What prepares lawyers to serve in that capacity and more of an administrative capacity, managing courts and all the things that come with that?
Yeah, the thing about becoming a judge, this is a good question that I've been asked as I've been knocking on doors and canvassing. They're asking me, do you take a test to in order to qualify to be a judge? Is there like a bar exam to become a lawyer? Is there one to become a judge? And no, there's not this like big bar exam or bench test that you take. The qualifications are being an attorney for at least 10 years, being in good standing with the state bar, and just the experience, so that experience that you've had in at least 10 years. I've been an attorney for almost 16, but those years of experience is what actually prepares you to be a fair and just judge. And there is going to be some time to catch your footing, because if, for example, Miss Adams becomes an attorney. When she becomes an attorney, very likely she will be placed in a non-criminal department, just because in the beginning they want her to not have too many conflicts of interest. And I've been working in family law and civil matters, and I'll likely not be in those departments and perhaps start in a criminal department, but it would be dealing with misdemeanors or like traffic court. And so you do get started at a certain level and you work your way up to more major crimes and felony court and that sort of thing. So there's some process in that just automatically happens with the court system.
Okay, I'm going to pitch it back to you, Deidre. So, when you're thinking about a position as a trial judge, you're sitting at this intersection, according to my understanding, of applying law, sometimes exercising discretion, but then overall managing a courtroom. And
Right.
so, when you're trying to accomplish these kind of three legs of the role of a trial judge, and when one of them conflicts with the other, how do you think through that process of managing a courtroom, but also sometimes needing to have some discretion about how things operate?
It depends, right? And as you just stated, a trial judge does manage the courtroom. A trial judge does decide matters in terms of evidentiary matters, makes objections, and not makes objections, but decides on objections and so forth. And some of that all happens simultaneously. And the best judges that I've seen handle that, handle it with grace, and they have the proper judicial temperament in doing so. And that's something that I bring to the bench as well. I have perfect temperament. I've dealt with people who have mental health issues, people who have drug addiction issues, people who are English is not their first language. So it's very important for a judge to have an even temperament, right, when presiding over matters.
And Deidre just gestured towards this, but Rosalina, I'd love for you to unpack it further, which is the role that empathy plays in the job of a judge. I think people imagine like laws, you have this statute and you just apply it, but it's more complicated than that. Can you talk about the role of empathy?
Absolutely. I think it's an important character to have to bring to the bench because you are impacting lives. And it's not just one human being that's being impacted by sentencing or the law, it's their entire family. And these are things that impact real people, real families. And judges should take into consideration all of the factors that bring that person into their courtroom. And so I will most definitely take into account socioeconomic issues, cultural issues, all of the things that might have contributed to getting that person in front of you. And it doesn't mean to say that I will treat that person differently or better or anything like that. Everyone will be treated equally and fairly. There's one set of laws that applies to everybody, but no one comes into your courtroom as a blank slate. They come in with different experiences, different traumas, different just factors that bring them in front of you. And so empathy is absolutely important. We want people to have regret, to also have empathy, right? If we're dealing with a defendant who has admitted to doing wrong, we want them to feel that, okay, I realize I did something wrong. I was not in my right state of mind. These are the things that now these are the consequences, and to accept those consequences and come out of that sentencing a different person and hopefully a better person, because it's not a matter of throwing people away forever. It shouldn't be that way. And empathy is absolutely essential.
So, Deidre, let's get into more current events related to Fresno. We're more than a year in, if not longer, into Prop 36, which is the retail theft and then also mental health diversion law that's supposed to address some of the challenges that happened during COVID and after. But we're seeing in following the news on this, we're seeing that there's just not enough mental health placements for a lot of these people that are put in these diversionary programs or options. Should that factor into a judge's mind in ordering a mental health diversion or placement if you know that there's not going to be capacity for them? Or is that more on county social services or whoever that they're contracting with to address that? Or do you get what I'm asking with that question?
I do. I think that's more so on county services and other agencies. A judge's decision is to apply the law, hear both sides, and determine what the outcome should be, right, in terms of the sentencing. And so a judge should not take into consideration, oh, there may not be housing available in this rehabilitation program or this mental health treatment program. That's not the judge's decision. The judge is to apply the law. And of course, because it's about public safety in the long run. So if we're sitting there worried about capacity of certain agencies or whether there's space available, I think that thought process is flawed. We have to be worried about the public and their safety.
Yeah. And this actually ties, I'll just follow up with this with you, Deidre, because this kind of builds on that. So if you are a judge and you've encountered a defendant that's failed treatment a second, third, whatever, however many times, when do you stop believing rehabilitation is the answer and you start believing that the criminal justice system itself, incarceration and those kind of things is necessary?
That should be determined on a case-by-case basis. I'm all about accountability.
Yeah, but
So
maybe the
that we
mental rubric
determine.
for how you think about it. Yeah.
It just depends. I'm not going to sit here and make a stance, unfortunately.
Yeah,
And I don't
fair
want to make
enough.
that stance. So I want to see things on a case-by-case basis, but I'm all about accountability and protecting the public.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go back to you, Rosalina, and talk a little bit about our CARE courts. So Fresno County was flagged by the state's CARE Improvement and Coordination Unit about the processing and functioning of our CARE courts. What does that tell you about how CARE courts are functioning locally, and what do we need to do to address that going forward?
Yes. So being flagged is telling us that something needs to perhaps be fixed, right? Or reviewed. And a lot of programs, they're not perfect. And I'll tell you right now that our justice system is not perfect. And so we are going to have programs like the CARE program that perhaps has some flaws, and we need to look at it and look at what's working and what isn't. And everything is always going to be a work in progress. Our community changes, the needs change, and we have to keep up with that. So, a program that works 10 years ago or 30 years ago perhaps is not going to be appropriate in 2026. But we have to look at what those changes are and how they're affecting our community. If they're working, if part of it is still working, maybe we take that forward. But we do have to look at flaws and try to fix those things.
Deidre, there's been critics of care courts saying that it's just dressed up homelessness policy and not really a mental health approach to, specifically for that reason. Does that factor in how you would review these cases, seeing it sometimes as an instrument for another goal other than the stated one in the law?
Here's how I see care courts. I actually just left care court this morning, and I was there for my client's mental health issues and to address that as it applied to his case. So I don't see it in that perspective. But let's just take it back to the core, right? A judge's responsibility and duty is to apply the law fairly according to what the case is about and according to what the law states, and to ensure that they're not trying to have background policy or politics interfere with that decision. So it's not about what people think it's just dressed up as, it's to address what it is. And again, I just left care court this morning. I was there for a mental health issue, so I don't see it as what you stated.
Okay. Rosalina, do you have a similar opinion, or does your opinion diverge from what Deidre just said?
No, I agree with Deidre. I have a lot of experience working with people that are unhoused and are dealing with a ton of mental health issues, people that are self-medicating. And in the nonprofit work that I've done, I have been able to get people to commit to rehab and to get to the methadone clinic. I've been able to get people on disability benefits, and together with another nonprofit program, have been able to get them connected to housing. And it has taken about two or 3 years to get people all the way to the point where, from the beginning, they've come in completely homeless, of nowhere to go, all the way to the point where now they're housed in a unit, they're clean and sober, they're on disability benefits, but working towards getting into a work program. And these, it's not the CARE program, but it almost has a similar mission statement. And they work, they're effective. People want to feel safe, they want to feel better. People don't want to stay on drugs forever and ever. There are people that want to help and people that want to be helped. And these programs can work. It does take work and it does take a village. But they are effective.
Yeah.
And can I just say,
Go
sorry, can I
ahead.
just say
Go ahead.
something? Oftentimes, homelessness and mental health go hand in hand, oftentimes. I've seen it all too often where you have people who have mental health issues, and because of that issues, they can't sustain a life. And so sometimes we are dealing with both of them going hand in hand. And it's also, again, it goes back to my original statement. We have to ensure public safety. We can't just say, okay, this person's homeless. That's the core of the issue. So we're not going to treat them, right? Because the core of the issue is public safety as well, and trying to get that individual the services that he or she needs to treat that mental health issue and to obviously get them off the streets if we can.
Next question is for you, Deidre, and it's an
Okay.
opportunity to gripe if you'd like. What's going on with eCourt?
Oftentimes, the court changes systems, right? Court systems,
But it's causing delays and
technology.
things, right? There's been issues, right?
Nothing's going to be 100% good to go, right? So they're working out the kinks, cooks and nannies and so forth. But I haven't had too much experience working with the new system, unfortunately. I do miss the old system, but I think I'm just older in my ways and just set in my ways. I just miss the old system.
Do you have any stories, Rosalina, or you haven't encountered much of it yet?
Not much yet. I fortunately have an incredible paralegal team that deals with a lot of the downloading and viewing and e-filing for me. But yeah, it's not perfect. The rollout has been a little bumpy. Every new program, again, it's not going to be perfect, but we look at the flaws and what's not working and it gets fixed. And anytime you're introduced into a new system, a software for your practice, there's always that learning curve, but we'll get through it.
Okay. This next question's for both of you, but I'll start with Rosalina. Backlogs on court cases can have major impacts on outcomes. We all know this. I guess the question just broadly, is there things that can be done from the judge's bench to mitigate some of the impacts of backlogs?
Yes, actually, that's one of the things that I really want to push for once on the bench is efficiency. Because when justice is delayed, that's an injustice. And it's an injustice to all sides, okay? Because people want to get things behind them as quickly as possible. Whether it's a civil matter or family, it's a contract dispute, or you're in criminal court, these things are very stressful. It's not something people cheer about. I've got a court today. I've got to go before a judge and I've got to deal with this horrible thing I'm going through, whether it's a divorce or fighting for custody. It's traumatic. People are literally in crisis and they want to get through it as quickly as possible. Of course, efficiency has to be appropriate. So we can't rush through things or rush through due process, or we have to apply the law appropriately, but it should be timely. And there are things that attorneys do for their parties, for their clients, that try to delay things, continue things out. And sometimes those things are appropriate because you need a little more time to collect evidence or to even review it. But of course, there are times when those are tactics to delay. And I want to be well aware of those tactics and definitely discourage those things because, again, a delay in justice is an injustice, in my opinion.
DJ, do you have things to add to that?
I do. Just to piggyback, court backlogs is a real issue because justice delays, it impacts everyone. It impacts victims, defendants, and families. And what I think can assist everyone in terms of a judge's perspective and reducing backlogs is running an efficient courtroom. That means being prepared, making timely rulings, keeping cases moving without unnecessary delays. And after over a decade in the courtroom, I understand where delays happen, and I know how to keep cases on track while still making fair and thoughtful decisions.
Let me pitch this next question back to you, Deidre. I use AI almost every day. I'm a Claude user. I've recently actually made my way from ChatGPT to Claude, which I'm proud of. I've
What is it
been
called? Clog?
Claude, Claude. Yeah, it's better, I think, but who knows? Deidre, how do you think AI will impact superior courts, let's say in the next 5 years? Are we already seeing that, or is that something that is seeping in through cracks, if you will? Where are we seeing AI's impact on the justice system?
I haven't seen it yet, to be candid
Okay.
with you. I just heard about that software program that you just mentioned today. So I haven't seen it yet. I know people are trying to utilize them with writing motions. I've seen people write a motion using ChatGPT, and people have to be very careful
Yes.
because ChatGPT has made up its own cases, and it may not even be an actual case. So I've seen that happen before in someone's motion. And so it's very important. Technology is a gift, but it's also a curse. We have to be very mindful when we utilize it.
Yeah, because there can be big consequences.
Correct.
So I've worked in public education for the last 15 years. I spend a lot of my days with kids, and trying to ensure that kids are on the right track for graduation and also making sure that they have opportunities before they get diverted to the criminal justice system is very important to me. And I'm curious, Rosalina, and then I'll also pitch this to you, Deidre, once she answers. I'm curious, when you're thinking about this, and the justice system is really premised on the idea that kids are different, whether that's brain development or whatnot, how should that translate into thinking about sentencing decisions for adolescents?
Yeah, so that goes back to even before sentencing them, is there's a determination whether that child is going to be tried as an adult. And it's a very controversial matter because there are a lot of people on the bench and attorneys that believe a certain age and below is a child, period. And then there's another mindset of where I don't think that they're really looking at even a number. They're looking more of what the alleged act is. And so that's where maybe judges get hung up on, is this an act that a child could have committed, or is this so horrible or so major that we're going to call this person an adult? And so that's a really controversial, real controversial waters there where it gets real muddy. And so even before you get to sentencing, there's a determination that's made. And so once you've gone through the trial and get to sentencing, that decision's already been made. It's a tricky one. And again, it's going to be a case by case thing, but age should matter. It does matter. When you're dealing with a 10-year-old and 12-year-old versus maybe a 17-year-old, that's a huge difference. So that is something I will definitely take into account, the actual number. And but of course, it's a case by case thing. You are going to look at what the alleged allegations are.
It definitely depends. Deidre, do you have other thoughts you want to add on that subject?
Yeah, legally, a person doesn't understand or have the capacity to understand the nature of the proceedings and sometimes the act by a certain age. We all understand and acknowledge that kids have different capacity levels. Like she gave an example of a certain age versus a 17-year-old, different capacity. But also, like she said, it's a case-by-case basis. You definitely have to look at the crime itself. Was this sophisticated? And there's so many different factors that a judge considers when it comes to sentencing a juvenile, right? The person's age, the person's capacity to understand, and how severe and sophisticated was the crime itself.
Yeah. We're seeing this right now with there's a very public trial about this exact subject. And
Right.
I'm sure there's going to be a lot of wrestling and hand-wringing with how to approach things.
Absolutely.
So California ended cash bail as a standalone system in a lot of contexts, but some of the tools that we've used to address some of those gaps, like risk assessment tools, have a lot of critics. Do you have a mental framework for how you think about pretrial detention decisions, like how you think about when they're necessary?
See, again, that's going to be a case by case.
Yeah, I'm sure every question I ask you guys can be just, it
Listen,
depends.
I'm
Yeah, I
going to
guess
give
I'm
you.
thinking like in big terms, like how do you, your philosophy behind it, how you think about approaching these decisions.
Yeah, I can't help it. I'm going to give you that big lawyer always statement is it depends. And as a judge, it will also depend. It really will. We're going to look at what the crime is, what the allegations are. Is this person a flight risk? Is this person the safety of the community? Is this person having some mental health issues where they're going to need to maybe get medicated and calm down before we just let them go back onto the streets? We're going to look at all of those different factors. Is this a repeat offender? All of those things matter, right? Is this a first-time offender and they've never committed anything before? Bad, wrong place, wrong time, and look at all of those factors. But yeah, the thing we do have to consider is this is an allegation. They've not been convicted of anything. They've not been found guilty. Are we going to hold them? And again, going back to your other question about delaying things, how long is this person going to sit in a county jail and have not ever committed anything before? All of those things need to be considered. So again, case by case sort
Yeah.
of mentality. Yeah.
Makes sense to me. In the academic world, I also saying it depends because it always does.
Right.
Deidre, when you think about Fresno County, it's heavily diverse, both ethnically, both socioeconomically, even geographically in terms of topography, urban versus rural. How important is it for our Superior Court judges to really represent the community?
I think it's very important for judges to have a well-balanced perspective and to bring that to the bench. Just, and I'll equate this to jury trials. I've done my fair share of jury trials, and people like the theory is you want to be judged by a jury of your peers. Now, oftentimes when my clients hear that, they really think it really means someone who's the same age as them and so forth. But you want to be judged by someone who identifies as you, right? Someone who have that familiarity, right? And so forth. So representation also matters. Our community, as a lot of communities in California, are pretty diverse. And I think it's important to also have the bench reflect that. Now, am I saying just have nothing but people of color? No, I think it should be a wide variety that reflects our community as a whole. And can I just piggyback off of the question you asked, Sabina?
Pretrial detention.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to know that judges do not get a copy of the police report. So they do rely heavily on the pretrial risk assessment that probation provides and prepares, and also what the district attorney represents, because they don't know the facts. They see the allegation and the complaint, and they don't know exactly what occurred. And so it's important for the judges to hear the facts, in which they do, before they make a determination as to whether there should be bail or no bail and what that bail amount should be. And of course, they have to balance that with public safety. They have to balance that with the crime itself. How egregious is the crime? How egregious was the conduct? Whether this was an isolated incident? And there's so many different factors that come into play. And like she stated, whether the person's a flight risk. They also assess whether this person has responded positively before to pretrial services, which is the services that allow someone to get out of custody, and probation, whether they were compliant with past probation terms if they have past criminal history.
Okay, this next question's for both of you, and it's broad. So we'll start with you, Rosalina. What's one area where you feel like Fresno County Superior Courts are functioning well? And then where is an area during your time, if you were elected, that you would like to see them improve? So maybe an area that's great and then a grow area.
Sure. I would have to say my arena has been more in civil and family law, and so I'll speak on that. I think I was just bragging yesterday that we have a really good mediation system for family law. Fresno County really does do a lot of good work with the mediation system that helps families try to make decisions for themselves before it goes to the judge. And so, even if people have filed paperwork and they're obviously in dispute and heading to trial to fight over assets in a divorce or their children for custody reasons, there is a good mediation system through the family court system that really encourages parties to try to mediate and get to middle ground. And even if they can't agree on every single issue, the parts that they agree on, the judge will adopt that as part of their order. And then it leaves just other small chunks or issues to go to trial for. And so that is really effective. Even as a practitioner, I've always encouraged parties to mediate and come to an agreement. Otherwise, this person who doesn't know you and doesn't know your children is going to decide what's best for your family. And sometimes that's necessary. That needs to happen. Parties can't agree, and that's what happens. And that judge also needs to be very decisive and make a decision and be comfortable with it. And so those things work. I think that there are probably a lot of more issues in the criminal arena, which is Deidre's specialty, and I'll let her speak on that. But I would probably guess that there are more issues in that arena.
Okay. Deidre, what's working well and where do we need to grow?
I think works well for us in terms of the criminal arena is that our judges, our bench, they are approachable. I've heard of other jurisdictions where if the district attorney offers the defendant something and if the defendant declines, then there's no other recourse but to go to trial and put it forth in front of the jurors. However, our bench is not like that. And I think that's amazing because oftentimes, if you get an offer, maybe something that you feel like it's unreasonable, or at least your client does, you're able to ask the court, can I approach? And the judges here are very approachable, like I said before. So I think that is great. That is phenomenal. Now, what's bad, and I believe this is probably all over the state, we have interpreter issues. So, as this host may be aware, we have a lot of Hispanics in Fresno and so forth, but we have other diverse groups. So, Spanish is not necessarily the issue, it's the other groups. Like, for instance, most recently, we had a young lady, this was this week, who needed a Romanian interpreter. And so we were able to get one, but by Zoom, and it's hard to have a meaningful, confidential conversation with someone who's out of custody or even in custody, but you have someone who's appearing by Zoom and supposed to interpret. That's an issue. Every now and then we have an ASL issue where you have a client who is deaf or having hearing issues. And there are other, even with the Spanish language, there are other dialects of Spanish, and it's so hard to find an interpreter sometimes. I remember years ago we had a client who, I believe this client was from Ethiopia, and it was difficult to try to find someone to interpret. So that's what I think it's not so great for our court system. But I think that does not affect just us. I think it's overall a court system issue overall.
Okay. I ask all my guests this question. I like for them to think about how the work that they've chosen to do affects the way they see the city of Fresno. So, for both of you, starting with Rosalina, how does the work that you've done change or altered your perspective on the city of Fresno?
I've been working with working families my entire career. Most recently, however, I have been working closer with people that are unhoused and suffering with severe mental health issues. And absolutely, it affects every time I turn the corner in my car. There's a community of homeless people on the street. There's our tents, there are sleeping bags. And I look at that and I know that it bothers a lot, a big part of the community. And I think it's because it's an unknown that perhaps we're fearful of that could happen to us at any given time. You're living paycheck to paycheck. There are a lot of families in Fresno County that are house insecure because it could happen, right? It could happen very quickly, quicker than we really realize. And so a lot of the sort of hatred for seeing people that are homeless and grouped up like that, I think it's more of a fear that people have and that we allow people to get to that point, that we don't have enough resources and programs to help people not be homeless. And so that's been a big part of my career the last few years. And so my eyes see it. I'm more aware of it. And I do want to help. I do, and I want the entire community to feel safe, not just our unhoused community, but everyone that walks next to that sort of camp should also feel safe. But I think it's really a lot of fear that's involved. And I think we need education and information and definitely more resources available.
Oh, Deidre, let me add a layer of the same question to you because I'm curious. If I were to spend each evening watching the local news and just consuming all the criminal activity that's going on, I would probably have a pretty dark perspective. And I think that informs a lot of the kind of lock 'em up mentality that a lot of people have, is that fed this kind of scary information. But at the same time, crime happens and it is a real thing and it is scary. How has working in that world affected the way you Fresno?
So my work has given me a very real and unfiltered view of Fresno. I work in an office that we see the worst of the worst, okay? I've seen people at their highest. I've seen people at their lowest moments of their lives, from victims to defendants and other families just going through the criminal justice system. When I say I also seen people at their highest, I've seen clients come back to me. Hey, do you remember me? You got me into an inpatient program. I am doing good. And this is real stories now. Years ago, one of my past clients came back to me and he told me he wasn't charged with a crime, but he came back to me and he said, I'm clean. I put on weight. And he did put on some weight, okay? And he said, I'm off drugs. He said, I'm now the director of one of the drug rehabilitation programs because you've helped me. So I've seen that aspect. I've seen the lowest aspects. As I told you before, I've seen people who have drug addiction issues, people who have mental health issues, and so forth. So I've seen the very unfiltered view of Fresno. But it also has shown me how strong the community of Fresno is, right? When people go through the criminal justice system, sometimes it's a matter of figuring out how they got there, how they got to where they are. I was explaining to a young lady yesterday that when I see clients, especially with my team, because I'm on the major crimes team, I always want to know the why and the how. How do we get here? How did you get here? And you hear all these stories of poverty, low education system, and so forth. And it just also showed me how deeply a judge's rulings impacts everybody, right? Not just your clients, but also their families, the victims' families, and so forth. And that perspective is very important for a judge who's on the bench to have that well-balanced perspective.
What would you like to recommend in terms of reading?
I am reading Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run.
Oh, so, I have that on my shelf. Should I pick it up?
You should. It's a good one. Yeah.
Okay. Well, did you learn anything interesting about the boss?
Work hard. Don't give up. Keep going. Chase your dreams. Be bold in your dreams. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Let's go. Deidre, yep. What would you like to recommend?
So I am big on biographies, memoirs, and so forth. So the most recent one that I read was Ketanji Brown. She's a Supreme Court Justice. And just watching and reading about how she progressed to the point that she's in currently right now. So that was my most recent book that I read. But I'm big on that. I'm big on even reading true crime. I know some people are like, don't you get enough of that? But I love books by Anne Rule. I previously, when I was studying for the bar exam, I felt really discouraged sometimes. So I read the book, The Alchemist. And so I don't know where it is for the life of me when I moved from law school into Fresno. So I repurchased it recently, but I just haven't had the time to reread it. But The Alchemist helped me whenever I got discouraged, just to read it and reflect on it. And it's about your dreams and trusting your path in life.
All right. To close, we'll start with Rosalina before going to Deidre. Where can people find out more about your campaign and what are any important dates or information you'd like to share before we wrap up? Rosalina, why don't you start us off?
Thank you. People can visit my website, nunezforjudge.com, nunezforjudge.com. And I will be posting upcoming events on there. We are going to make a big appearance at the Clovis Rodeo. We will have a little float go through there.
Nice.
And we will also be at the Sikh Temple this weekend. We'll have a booth out there. So
nice. Deidre?
Yes. So my website is adamsforjudge.org, O-R-G. You can also find me on Facebook. I believe it's the same title, Adams for Judge, on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram as well. I believe both pages may be connected. Like she just stated, this weekend we're planning on being at the Sikh Temple. So those are the main ways to find me on social media. I also have a phone number. I'll give my direct line. It goes straight to me, no staff. 559 area code 249-8036. Again, 559 area code 249-8036. You can also reach me by email as adamsforjudge@yahoo.com. And that's Adams, the common spelling, ADAMS, for judge at yahoo.com.
Okay. So June 2nd, right?
That's right.
That's
June 2nd.
Until then, we're going to have all those signs everywhere. How many total people are running for judge? It feels like half the city's running at the moment.
That's right. There are seven open
seats. I don't know the exact number. I know they have seven vacancies. Oh.
Yes, seven open seats, and they're only one is uncontested or unopposed, I should say, and the rest of them have three or two candidates in each. And yes, the ballot is going to be very long in Fresno County this June 2nd, and the judges' slots will be at the very end. So we are encouraging people to start at the bottom of the ballot, mark our names, and then work your way up.
Yeah, it's reading the last page in a book. You need to know what happens before the
get
end.
Get to the good part.
Yeah.
Rosalina, Deidre, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
No, thank you for taking the time to interview us. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Jordan.
Fresno's best.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.